He picked up the mini-tape machine he used for notes and said, "Find out how much of the PRC military purchases have been executed financially, especially Israel." He clicked the stop button, set it down, and picked the DVD controller back up to continue his movie, but soon found he couldn't concentrate on it very well. Something big was happening, and experienced as he was in the world of commerce, and now in the business of international transactions, he realized that he didn't have a handle on it. That didn't happen to George Winston very often, and it was enough to keep him from laughing at Men in Black. Her minister didn't look very happy, Ming saw. The look on his face made her think that he might have lost a family member to cancer. She found out more when he called her in to dictate his notes. It took fully 90 minutes this time, and then 2 entire hours for her to transcribe them into her computer. She hadn't exactly forgotten what her computer probably did with them every night, but she hadn't thought about it in weeks. She wished she had the ability to discuss the note's content with Minister Fang. Over the years of working for him, she'd acquired rather a sophisticated appreciation for the politics of her country, to the point that she could anticipate not only the thoughts of her master, but also those of some of his colleagues. She was, in effect, if not in fact, a confidant of her minister, and while she could not counsel him on his job, if he'd had the wit to appreciate the effect of her education and her time inside his head, he might have used her far more efficiently than as a mere secretary. But she was a woman in a land ruled by men, and therefore voiceless. Orwell had been right. She'd read Animal Farm some years ago. Everyone was equal, but some were more equal than others. If Fang were smart, he'd use her more intelligently, but he wasn't, and he didn't. She'd talk to Nomori-san about that tonight. For his part, Chester was just finalizing an order for 1,661 high-end NEC desktops at the China Precision Machine Import and Export Corporation, which, among other things, made guided missiles for the People's Liberation Army. That would make Nippon Electric Company pretty happy. The sad part was that he couldn't rig these machines to talk as glibly as the two in the Council of Ministers. But that would have been too dangerous, if a good daydream over a beer and a smoke. Chester Nomori, cyber spy. Then his beeper started vibrating. He reached down and gave it a look. The number was 745-4426. Applied to the keys on a phone, and selecting the right letters, that translated in personal code to Shingan, heart and soul, Ming's private endearment for her lover, and an indication that she wanted to come over to his place tonight. That suited Nomori just fine. So he'd turned into James Bond after all. Good enough for a private smile as he walked out to his car. He flipped open his shoe phone, dialed up his email access, and sent his own message over the net, 226-234, Bao Bei. Beloved one. She liked to hear him say that, and he didn't mind saying it. So, something other than TV for tonight. Good. He hoped he had enough of the Japanese scotch for the après-sex. You knew you had a bad job when you welcomed a trip to the dentist. Jack had been going to the same one for 19 years. But this time it involved a helicopter flight to a Maryland State Police barracks with its own helipad, followed by 5 minutes in a car to the dentist's office. He was thinking about China, but his principal bodyguard mistook his expression. "Relax, boss," Andrea told the president. "If he makes you scream, I'll cap him." You shouldn't be up so early, Ryan responded crossly. Dr. North said I could work my regular routine until further notice, and I just started the vitamins she likes. Well, Pat looks rather pleased with himself. It had been a pleasant evening at the White House. It was always good to entertain guests who had no political agenda. What is it about you guys? You strut like roosters, but we have to do all the work. Andrea, I would gladly switch jobs with you, Ryan joked. He'd had this discussion with Kathy often enough, claiming that having a baby couldn't be all that hard. Men had to do almost all of the tough work in life. But he couldn't joke with someone else's wife that way. Nomori heard his computer beep in the distance, meaning it had received and was now automatically encrypting and retransmitting the date emailed from Ming's desktop. It made an entertaining interruption to his current activity. It had been 5 days since their last tryst, and that was a long enough wait for him, and evidently for her as well, judging by the passion in her kisses. In due course it was over, and they both rolled over for a smoke. How is the office? Nomori asked, with the answer to his question now residing in a server in Wisconsin.
The Politburo is debating great finance. Chan, the minister in charge of our money, is trying to persuade the Politburo to change its ways. But they're not listening as Minister Fang thinks they ought.
Oh?
He's rather angry with his old comrades for their lack of flexibility.
Then Ming giggled.
Chai said the minister was very flexible with her 2 nights ago.
Not a nice thing to say about a man, Ming, Nomori chided.
I would never say it about you and your jade sausage, Shingan, she said, turning for a kiss.
Do they argue often there? In the Politburo, I mean.
There are frequent disagreements, but this is the first time in months that the matter has not been resolved to Fang's satisfaction. They are usually collegial, but this is a disagreement over ideology. Those can be violent, at least in intellectual terms. Obviously, the Politburo members were too old to do much more than smack an enemy over the head with their canes.
And this one?
Minister Chan says the country may soon be out of money. The other ministers say that is nonsense. Chan says we must accommodate the Western countries. Zhang and the others like him say we cannot show weakness after all they, especially the Americans, have done to us lately.
Don't they see that killing that Italian priest was a bad thing?
They see it as an unfortunate accident, and besides, he was breaking our laws.
Jesus, Nomori thought, they really do think they're God-kings, don't they? Bao Bei, that is a mistake on their part.
You think so?
I have been to America, remember? I lived there for a time. Americans are very solicitous to their clergy, and they place a high value on religion. Spitting on it angers them greatly.
You think Chan is right, then? She asked. You think America will deny us money for this foolish action?
I think it is possible, yes. Very possible, Ming.
Minister Fang thinks we should take a more moderate course, to accommodate the Americans somewhat, but he did not say so at the meeting.
Oh, why?
He does not wish to depart too greatly from the path of the other ministers. You say that in Japan people fear not being elected. Here, well, the Politburo elects its own, and it can expel those who no longer fit in. Fang does not wish to lose his own status, obviously, and to make sure that doesn't happen, he takes a cautious line.
This is hard for me to understand, Ming. How do they select their members? How do the princes choose the new prince?
Oh, there are party members who have distinguished themselves ideologically, or sometimes from work in the field.
Minister Qian, for example, used to be chief of railroad construction, and was promoted for that reason. But mainly they are picked for political reasons.
And Fang?
My minister is an old comrade. His father was one of Mao's faithful lieutenants, and Fang has always been politically reliable. But in recent years, he has taken note of the new industries and seen how well they function. And he admires some of the people who operate them. He even has some into his office from time to time for tea and talk.
So the old pervert is a progressive here? Nomori wondered.
Well, the bar for that was pretty low in China. You didn't have to jump real high. But that put him in advance of the ones who dug a trench under it, didn't it?
Ah, so the people have no voice at all, do they?
Ming laughed at that.
Only at party meetings, and there you guard your voice.
Are you a member?
Oh, yes, I go to meetings once a month. I sit in the back. I nod when others nod, and applaud when they applaud, and I pretend to listen. Others probably listen better. It is not a small thing to be a party member, but my membership is because of my job at the ministry. I am here because they needed my language and computer skills, and besides, the ministers like to have young women under them, she added.
You're never on top of him, eh?
He prefers the ordinary position, but it is hard on his arms,
Ming giggled.
Ryan was glad to see that he was brushing enough. The dentist told him to floss, as he always did, and Ryan nodded, as he always did, and he'd never bought floss in his life and wasn't going to start now. But at least he'd undergone nothing more invasive than a couple of x-rays, for which, of course, he'd gotten the leather apron. On the whole, it had been 90 minutes torn off the front of his day. Back in the Oval Office, he had the latest Zorga, which was good enough for a whispered, "Damn." He lifted the phone for Mary Pat at Langley.
"They're dense," Ryan observed.
"Well, they sure as hell don't know high finance. Even I know better than this."
"Trader has to see this. Put him on the Zorga list," POTUS ordered.
"With your day-to-day approval only," the DDO hedged. "Maybe he has a need to know on economics, but nothing else, okay?"
"Okay, for now," Jack agreed.
But George was coming along nicely on strategic matters, and might turn into a good policy advisor. He understood high-stress psychology better than most, and that was the name of the game. Jack broke the connection and had Ellen Sumter call the Sec-Trez over from across the street.
"So what else do they worry about?" Chester asked.
"They're concerned that some of the workers and peasants are not as happy as they should be. You know about the riots they had in the coal region?"
"Oh?"
"Yes. The miners rioted last year. The PLA went in to settle things down. Several hundred people were shot, and 3,000 arrested."
She shrugged while putting her bra back on.
"There is unrest, but that is nothing especially new. The army keeps control of things in the outlying regions. That's why they spend so much money, to keep the army reliable. The generals run the PLA's economic empire, all the factories and things, and they're good at keeping a lid on things. The ordinary soldiers are just workers and peasants. But the officers are all party members, and they are reliable, or so the Politburo thinks."
"It's probably true," Ming concluded.
She hadn't seen her minister worry all that much about it. Power in the People's Republic decidedly grew from the barrel of a gun, and the Politburo owned all the guns. That made things simple, didn't it? For his part, Nomori had just learned things he'd never thought about before. He might want to make his own report on this stuff. Ming probably knew a lot of things that didn't go out as songbird material. And he'd be remiss not to send that to Langley, too. It's like a 5-year-old in a gun store, Secretary Winston observed. These people have no business making economic decisions for a city government, much less a major country. I mean, hell, as stupid as the Japanese were a few years ago, at least they know to listen to the coaches. And when they run into the brick wall, their eyes'll still be closed. That can smart some, Jack. They're going to get bit on the ass, and they don't see it coming. Winston could mix metaphors with the best of them, Ryan saw. When? Swordsman asked. Depends on how many companies do what Butterfly did. We'll know more in a few days. The fashion business will be the lead indicator of all things.
Really?
Surprised me, too. But this is the time for them to commit to the next season. And there's a ton of money in that business going on over there, man. Toss in all the toys for next Christmas. There's 17 billion plus just in that, Mark Gant tells me.
Damn.
Yeah, I didn't know Santa's reindeer had slanted eyes either, Jack. At least not to that extent.
What about Taiwan? Ryan wondered.
You're not kidding. They're jumping into the growing gap with both feet. Figure they pick up a quarter, maybe a third of what the PRC is going to lose. Singapore is going to be next, and the ties. This little bump in the road will go a long way to restore the damage done to their economy a few years back. In fact, the PRC's troubles might rebuild the whole South Asian economy. It could be a swing of $50 billion out of China, and it has to go somewhere. We're starting to take bids, Jack. It won't be a bad deal for our consumers, and I'll bet those countries learn from Beijing's example and kick their doors open a notch or so. So our workers will profit from it, too. Somewhat, anyway.
Downside?
Boeing's squealing some. They wanted that 777 order, but you wait and see. Somebody's going to take up that slack, too.
One other thing.
Yeah? Ryan asked.
It's not just American companies bailing out on them.
Two big Italian places, and Siemens in Germany, they've announced termination of some business with their Chinese partners, Trader said.
Will it turn into a general movement?
Too soon to say, but if I were these guys, Winston shook the facts from CIA, I'd be thinking about fence mending real soon.
They won't do it, George.
Then they're going to learn a nasty lesson.
Chapter 39 The Other Question.
No action with our friend? Riley asked. Well, he continues his sexual adventures, Provolov answered.
Talked to any of the girls yet?
Earlier today, two of them. He pays them well in euros or D-marks and doesn't request any, exotic services from them.
Nice to know he's normal in his tastes, the FBI agent observed with a grunt.
We have numerous photos of him now. We've put an electronic tracker on his cars, and we've also planted a bug on his computer keyboard. That'll allow us to determine his encryption password next time he makes use of it.
But he hasn't done anything incriminating yet, Riley said.
He didn't even make it a question.
Not under our observation, Oleg confirmed.
Damn, so he was really trying to whack Sergei Golovko. Hard to believe, man.
Well, that is so, but we cannot deny it. And on Chinese orders.
That's like an act of war, buddy. It's a big fucking deal.
Riley took a sip of his vodka.
So it is, Mishka. Rather more complex than any case I've handled this year.
It was, Provolov thought, an artful understatement. He'd gladly go back to a normal homicide, a husband killing his wife for fucking a neighbor, or the other way around. Such things, nasty as they were far less nasty than this one was.
How's he pick the girls up, Oleg? Riley asked.
He doesn't call for them on the phone. He seems to go to a good restaurant with a good bar and wait until a likely prospect appears at his elbow.
Plant a girl on him?
What do you mean? I mean, get yourself a pretty girl who does this sort of thing for a living. Brief her on what she ought to say, and set her in front of him like a nice fly on your fishhook. If he picks her up, maybe she can get him to talk. Have you ever done such a thing? We got a wise guy that way in Jersey City 3 years ago. Liked to brag in front of women how tough he was, and the guys he whacked, that sort of thing. He's in Rahway State Prison now on a murder rap. Oleg, a lot more people have talked their way into prison than you'll ever catch on your own. Trust me. That's how it is for us, even. I wonder if the Sparrow School has any graduates working, Provolov mused. It wasn't fair to do it at night, but nobody had ever said war was marked by fairness in its execution. Colonel Boyle was in his command post monitoring the operation of 1st Armored's Aviation Brigade. It was mainly his Apaches, though some Kiowa warriors were up too, as scouts for the heavy shooters. The target was a German heavy battalion, simulating a night's lagering after a day on the offense. In fact, they were pretending to be Russians. It was a NATO scenario that went back 30 years to the introduction of the first Huey Cobras, back in the 1970s, when the value of a helicopter gunship had first been noticed in Vietnam. And a revelation it had been. Armed for the first time in 1972 with TOW missiles, they'd proven to the tanks of the North Vietnamese just how fearsome a foe a missile-armed chopper could be. And that had been before night vision systems had come fully online. Now the Apache turned combat operations into sport shooting, and the Germans were still trying to figure a counter for it. Even their own night vision gear didn't compensate for the huge advantage held by the airborne hunters. One idea that had almost worked was to lay a thermal insulating blanket over the tanks so as to deny the helicopters the heat signature by which they hunted their motionless prey. But the problem there was the tank's main gun tube, which had proved impractical to conceal, and the blankets had never really worked properly, any more than a twin-bed coverlet could be stretched over a king-size bed. And so now the Apache's laser illumination systems were painting the Leos for enough seconds to guarantee hits from the Hellfire missiles. And while the German tanks tried to shoot back, they couldn't seem to make it work. And now the yellow "I'm dead" lights were blinking. And yet another tank battalion had fallen victim to yet another administrative attack. They should have tried putting SAM teams outside their perimeter, Colonel Boyle observed, watching the computer screen. Instead, the German colonel had tried IR lures, which the Apache gunners had learned to distinguish from the real thing. Under the rules of the scenario, proper tank decoys had not been allowed. They were a little harder to discriminate. The American-made ones almost exactly replicated the visual signature of an M1 tank, and had an internal heat source for fooling infrared gear at night, and fired off a Hoffman pyrotechnic charge to simulate a return shot when they took a hit. But they were made so well for their mission that they could not be mistaken for anything other than what they were, either a real M1 main battle tank and hence friendly, or a decoy, and thus not really useful in a training exercise. All in all, a case of battlefield technology being too good for a training exercise. Pegasus lead to Archangel, over, the digital radio called. With the new radios, it was no longer a static-marred crackle. Archangel to Pegasus, Colonel Boyle answered. Sir, we are Winchester and just about out of targets. No friendly casualties. Pegasus is RTB, over. Roger, Pegasus. Looks good from here, out. And with that, the Apache battalion of attack choppers and their Kiowa bird dogs turned back for their airfield for the mission debrief and post-game beers. Boyle looked over at General Diggs. Sir, I don't know how to do it much better than that. Our hosts are going to be pissed. The Bundeswehr isn't what it used to be. Their political leadership thinks peace has broken out all the way, and their troopers know it.
They could have put some of their own choppers up to run interference, but my boys are pretty good at air-to-air. We train for it, and my pilots really like the idea of making ace on their own. But their chopper drivers aren't getting all the gas they need for operational training. Their best chopper drivers are down in the Balkans doing traffic observation.
Diggs nodded thoughtfully.
The problems of the Bundeswehr were not, strictly speaking, his problems.
Colonel, that was well done. Please convey my pleasure to your people.
What's next for you?
General, we have a maintenance stand down tomorrow, and 2 days later we're going to run a major search and rescue exercise with my Blackhawks. You're welcome to come over and watch.
I just might, Colonel Boyle.
You done good.
Be seeing you.
Yes, sir. The colonel saluted, and General Diggs walked out to his Humvee with Colonel Masterman in attendance.
Well, Duke?
Like I told you, sir, Boyle's been feeding his boys and girls a steady diet of nails and human babies.
Well, his next fitness report's going to get him a star, I think.
His Apache commander's not bad either.
That's a fact, the divisional G3 agreed.
Pegasus was his call sign, and he'd kicked some serious ass this night.
What's next?
Sir, in 3 days we have a big SIMNET exercise against the Big Red One at Fort Riley. Our boys are pretty hot for it.
Divisional readiness? Diggs asked.
We're pushing 95%, General. Not much slack left to take up. I mean, sir, to go any farther, we got to take the troops out to Fort Irwin or maybe the Negev training area.
Are we as good as the 10th Cav or the 11th?
No, we don't get to play in the field as much as they do.
And he didn't have to add, no division in any army in the world got the money to train that hard.
But given the limitations we have to live with, there's not a whole lot more we can do. I figure we play hard on SIMNET to keep the kids interested, but we're just about as far as we can go, sir.
I think you're right, Duke.
You know, sometimes I kind of wish the Cold War could come back, for training purposes, anyway. The Germans won't let us play the way we used to back then, and that's what we need to take the next step.
Unless somebody springs for the tickets to fly a brigade out to California, Masterman nodded.
That ain't gonna happen, Duke, Diggs told his operations officer.
And more was the pity. First Tank's troops were almost ready to give the Black Horse a run for their money. Close enough, Diggs thought, that he'd pay to watch.
How's a beer grab you, Colonel?
If the General is buying, I will gladly assist him in spending his money, Duke Masterman said graciously, as their sergeant driver pulled up to the Caserne's O Club.
Good morning, Comrade General, Gogol said, pulling himself to attention.
Bondarenko had felt guilted coming to see this old soldier so early in the morning. But he'd heard the day before that the ancient warrior was not one to waste daylight. And so he wasn't, the general saw.
You kill wolves, Gennady Yosifovich observed, seeing the gleaming pelts hanging on the wall of this rough cabin.
And bear, but when you gild the pelts, they grow too heavy, the old man agreed, fetching tea for his guests.
These are amazing, Colonel Aliyev said, touching one of the remaining wolf pelts. Most had been carried off.
It's an amusement for an old hunter, Gogol said, lighting a cigarette.
General Bondarenko looked at his rifles, the new Austrian-made one, and the old Russian M1891 Mosin Nagant sniper rifle.
How many with this one? Bondarenko asked.
Wolves? Bears?
Germans. The general clarified, with coldness in his voice.
I stopped counting at 30, Comrade General. That was before Kiev. There were many more after that. I see we share a decoration, Gogol observed, pointing to his visitor's gold star, for Hero of the Soviet Union, which he'd won in Afghanistan.
Gogol had two, one from Ukraine and the other in Germany.
You have the look of a soldier, Pavel Petrovich, and a good one,
Bondarenko sipped his tea, served properly, a clear glass and a metal, was it silver, holder.
I served in my time, first at Stalingrad, then on the long walk to Berlin.
I bet you did walk all the way, too, the general thought. He'd met his share of great patriotic war veterans, now mostly dead. This wizened old bastard had stared death in the face and spat at it, trained to do so, probably, by his life in these woods. He'd grown up with bears and wolves as enemies, as nasty as the German fascists had been, at least they didn't eat you, and so had been accustomed to wagering his life on his eye and his nerve. There was no real substitute for that, the kind of training you couldn't institute for an army. A gifted few learned how the hard way, and of those the lucky ones survived the war. Pavel Petrovich hadn't had an easy time. Soldiers might admire their own snipers, might value them for their skills, but you could never say comrade to a man who hunted men as though they were animals, because on the other side of the line might be another such man who wanted to hunt you. Of all the enemies, that was the one you loathed and feared the most, because it became personal to see another man through a telescopic sight, to see his face, and take his life as a deliberate act against one man, even gazing at his face when the bullet struck. Gogol had been one of those, Gennady thought, a hunter of individual men. And he'd probably never lost a minute's sleep over it. Some men were just born to it, and Pavel Petrovich Gogol was one of them. With a few hundred thousand such men, a general could conquer the entire world. But they were too rare for that. And maybe that was a good thing, Bondarenko mused. Might you come to my headquarters some night? I would like to feed you dinner and listen to your stories. How far is it? I will send you my personal helicopter, Sergeant Gogol. And I will bring you a gilded wolf, the hunter promised his guest. We will find an honored place for it at my headquarters, Bondarenko promised in turn. Thank you for your tea. I must depart and see to my command, but I will have you to headquarters for dinner, Sergeant Gogol. Handshakes were exchanged, and the general took his leave. I would not want him on the other side of a battlefield, Colonel Aliyev observed, as they got into their helicopter. Do they have a sniper school in the command? Yes, General, but it's mainly inactive. Gennady turned. Start it up again, Andrushka. We'll get Gogol to come and teach the children how it's done. He's a priceless asset. Men like that are the soul of a fighting army. It's our job to command our soldiers, to tell them where to go and what to do, but those are the men who do the fighting and the killing. And it's our job to make sure they're properly trained and supplied. And when they're too old, we use them to teach the new boys, to give them heroes they can touch and talk to. How the hell did we ever forget that, Andrei? The general shook his head as the helicopter lifted off. Gregory was back in his hotel room, with 300 pages of technical information to digest, as he sipped his Diet Coke and finished off his French fries. Something was wrong with the whole equation, but he couldn't put his finger on it. The Navy had tested its standard 2ER missile against all manner of threats, mainly on computer, but also against live targets at Kwajalein Atoll. It had done pretty well, but there had never been a full-up live test against a for-real ICBM re-entry vehicle. There weren't enough of them to go around. Mainly they used old Minuteman II ICBMs, long since retired from service and fired out of test silos at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. But those were mostly gone. Russia and America had retired all of their ballistic weapons, chiefly as a reaction to the nuclear terrorist explosion at Denver, and the even more horrific aftermath that had barely been averted. The negotiations to draw the numbers down to zero, The last ones had been eliminated in public just before the Japanese had launched their sneak attack on the Pacific Fleet, had gone so rapidly that a lot of the minor ancillary points had scarcely been considered. And only later had it been decided to take the spare launchers whose disposition had somehow been overlooked and retain them for ABM testing. Every month a Russian officer checked the American ones at Vandenberg, and an American officer counted the Russian ones outside Plesetsk. The ABM tests were also monitored, but that entire area of effort was now largely theoretical. Both America and Russia retained a goodly number of nuclear warheads, and these could easily be affixed to cruise missiles, which again both sides had in relative abundance, and no country could stop. It might take 5 hours instead of 34 minutes, but the targets would be just as dead. Anti-missile work had been relegated to theater missiles, such as the ubiquitous Scuds, which the Russians doubtless regretted ever having built, much less sold to jerkwater countries that couldn't even field a single decent mechanized division, but who loved to parade those upgraded V2-class ballistic stovepipes because they looked impressive as hell to the people on the sidewalks. But the new upgrades on Patriot and its Russian counterpart SAM largely negated that threat, and the Navy's Aegis system had been tested against them, with pretty good success. Like Patriot, though, Standard was really a point defense weapon with damned little cross-range ability to cover an area instead of maybe 20 square miles of important sea estate. All in all, it was a pity that they'd never solved the power throughput problem with his free electron lasers. Those could have defended whole coastlines, if only... And if only his aunt had balls, Gregory thought she'd be his uncle. There was talk of building a chemical laser aboard a converted 747 that could sure as hell clobber a ballistic launch during boost phase. But to do that, the 747 had to be fairly close to the launch point. And so that was just one more version of theater defense, and of little strategic use. The Aegis system had real possibilities. The spy radar system was first-rate, and though the computer that managed the information was the flower of 1975 technology, a current Apple Macintosh had it beat by a good 3 orders of magnitude in all categories of performance. Intercepting a ballistic warhead wasn't a question of computing speed so much as kinetic energy, getting the kill vehicle to the right place at the right time. Even that wasn't so great a feat of engineering. The real work had been done as far back as 1959, with the Nike Zeus, which had turned into Spartan and shown great promise before being shit-canned by the 1972 treaty with the Soviet Union, which was belatedly just as dead as the safeguard system, which had been aborted at half-built. Well, the fact of the matter was that MIRV technology had negated that entire defense concept. No, you had to kill the ICBM in boost phase to kill all the MIRVs at once, and do it over the enemy's territory, so that if he had a primitive arming system, he'd only fry his own turf. The method for doing that was the brilliant Pebble system developed at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And though it had never been given a full-up test, the technology was actually pretty straightforward. Being hit by a matchstick traveling at 15,000 miles per hour would ruin your entire day. But that would never happen. The drive to fund and deploy such a system had died with all the ballistic launchers. In a way, it was a pity, Gregory thought. Such a system would have been a really cool engineering accomplishment, but it had little practical application today. The PRC retained its land-based ballistic launchers, but there were only 10 or so of them, and that was a long way from the 1,500 the Soviets had once pointed at America. The Chinese had a missile submarine too, but Gregory figured that SyncPak could make that go away if he had to. Even if it was just tied alongside the pier, one 2,000-pound smart bomb could take it out of play, and the Navy had a lot of those. So, he thought, figure the PRC gets really pissed at Taiwan. And figure the Navy has an Aegis cruiser tied alongside so that its sailors can get drunk and laid in the city. and those folks in Beijing picked that moment to push the button on one of their ICBMs. How can the Navy keep its cruiser from turning into slag? And, oh, by the way, keep the city of Taipei alive. The SM-2ER had almost enough of the right ingredients to handle such a threat. If the missile was targeted on where the cruiser was, cross-range was not an issue. You just had to put the interceptor on the same line of bearing, because, in essence, the inbound rack wasn't moving at all. And you just had to put the SAM in the same place, spot X, that the RV was going to be at time Y. The Aegis computer could figure where and when that was, and you weren't really hitting a bullet with a bullet. The RV would be about a meter across, and the kill zone of the SAM's warhead would be about, what, 3 meters across? 5? Maybe even 8 or 10. Call it 8, Al Gregory thought. Was the SM-2 that accurate? In absolute terms, probably yes. It had ample-sized control surfaces, and getting into the line of a jet aircraft, what the SM-2 had been designed to kill, had to take into account the maneuverability of the aircraft. Pilots would do their damnedest to avoid the things, and so the 8-meter globe of destruction could probably be made to intercept the inbound RV in terms of pure geometry. The issue was speed. Gregory popped open another Diet Coke from the room's minibar and sat back on the bed to consider how troublesome that issue was. The inbound RV, at 100,000 feet, would be traveling at about 16,000 miles per hour, 23,466 feet per second, 8 times the speed of a rifle bullet, 7,150 meters per second. That was pretty damn fast. It was about the same speed as a high explosive detonation. You could have the RV sitting next to a ton of TNT at the moment the explosive went off, and the explosion couldn't catch up with the RV. That was fast. So the SAM's warhead has to go off well before it gets to where the RV is. Figuring out how much was a simple mathematical exercise. That meant that the proximity fuse on the SM-2 was the important variable in the equation, Gregory decided. He didn't know that he was wrong on this, didn't see what he was missing, and went on with his calculations. The software fix for the proximity laser fusing system looked less difficult than he'd imagined. Well, wasn't that good news? It was another early day for Minister Fang Gan. He'd gotten a phone call at his home the previous night, and decided he had to arrive early for the appointment made then. This was a surprise for his staff, who were just setting up for the day when he breezed in, not looking as cross as he felt for the disturbance of his adamantine routine. It wasn't their fault, after all, and they had the good sense not to trouble him, and thus generate artificial wrath. Ming was just printing up her downloads from the web. She had pieces that she thought would be of interest, especially one from the Wall Street Journal, and another from Financial Times. Both commented on what she thought might be the reason for the minister's early arrival. His 9:20 appointment was with Ren Heiping, an industrialist friendly with her boss. Ren arrived early. The slender, elderly man looked unhappy. No, she thought, worried about something. She lifted her phone to get permission, then stood and walked him into the inner office, racing back outside to fetch morning tea, which she hadn't had a chance to serve her boss yet. Ming was back inside in less than 5 minutes, with the fine porcelain cups on a decorated serving tray.